Does truth exist?
Because you have faith, does that make this book true?
Does God exist?
So when someone says there is no truth, if you apply the claim to itself, what should you say? Is that true? They don't think Christianity's true. They're talked out of it. You know why they're talked out of it? Because they've never been talked into it.
Cross-examining skeptical and atheistic views. Welcome to Cross-Examine with Dr. Frank Turek.
Ladies and gentlemen, how does the censorship trend affect your doctor? What can he or she prescribe or not prescribe to you? How does the censorship trend affect your kid at school? How does it affect you online? What you can see, what you can't see. It might even affect what you can say and can't say in your own company. And what can we do about it? We're going to continue our conversation today that we had last week on the American Family Radio Network with my friend Seth Dillon, the CEO of the Babylon Bee. We have many more issues to unpack. Another issue we have to unpack is, you know, we're talking about censorship here, and we did in the previous program, but doesn't the right want to censor people too? Don't they want to ban certain books from school libraries? What about that? We need to get it into all that with Seth, who, as I mentioned in the last show, if you haven't listened to the previous show, you need to go back and listen to that, because Seth actually testified before Congress last year on this. That's worth hearing, as well as our conversation. So let's jump right back in. Seth, thanks for joining us again. Let's talk about censorship from the right, if we can, for just a minute, because we're complaining here how the left is using the government, or the government's using big tech and the left to censor people on the right. But doesn't the right try and censor people by banning books in, say, school libraries?
Well, there's definitely a danger. I think human nature is to say that, well, for my friends, you know, there should be a lot of leeway and freedom, and for my enemies, you know, the law should apply to them, and there should be restrictions because what they say and do is bad and it threatens me. And both sides can try to say that, you know, both sides can try to say that the other side has morality wrong and that the standards that they want to apply to everybody else are wrong. And I oppose that, and I don't want to see that. You know, like, the right doesn't want wokeness infecting schools, for example. The right doesn't want kids to be indoctrinated at early ages. And the left thinks that's perfectly fine and acceptable. And so it can often lead to the accusation that, okay, well, the right is every bit as in favor of cancel culture or censorship as the left, because they're trying to prevent these things from being taught or said or encountered. But you gotta look at the specifics of, like, what exactly is it that the right doesn't want in schools, and are they right to not want it in schools? And if you look at, for example, some of the stuff that some of the books that we're trying to keep out of the hands of children, they literally include explicit sexual material, graphic sexual material, and some of these are like graphic novels, so it's actually pornographic material. It's not just in writing. There's actual imagery talking about inappropriate things for the ages of the children that are getting their hands on these books. And so what the right is trying to say is, you know, kids shouldn't be encountering this stuff at a certain age. And that was really, I mean, that was the predominant view amongst pretty much everybody until very recently. I don't think anybody, if you go back 10 years, just 10 years, I don't think anybody left or right would think that drag shows should be performed for children. I think that everybody agreed that was something that should, if it's going to happen at all, because a lot of people would think that it shouldn't happen at all, but if it's going to happen, at least put it behind doors where you have to be, you know, 21 and up to enter or something like that. Make it an adult thing. Don't expose children to it. But now, you know, it's become very popular and common for the left to try to sneak this stuff into curriculum and into libraries. And the right is saying, whoa, there should be limits on what we expose children to. And there's reasons for those limits. And this is not a speech issue. It's not an issue where we're trying to say that, we're trying to control what teachers are allowed to talk about or whatever. It's more of, this is just age inappropriate for children. pornography should not be in school libraries for children. And that shouldn't be controversial to say. And it doesn't amount to book banning where it's, oh, I don't like those political viewpoints, therefore it shouldn't be in print. Because that's what the left did. When you looked at, Abigail Schreier's book, Irreversible Damage, they wanted it removed from Amazon. And I think they actually got it. Didn't they get it taken down from Amazon or Target or somewhere?
What they got was not Abigail's book taken down, but they took down Ryan T. Anderson's book.
They definitely took down his book when Harry became Sally.
That's right. Yeah.
His book got taken down. I think they tried to get Abigail's taken down. I'm sure I do believe that hers was censored somewhere, mm-hmm. but that's a situation where you have content for adults written by adults, for a matter of great public importance. This is an issue that's being debated in our culture, and the cultural and institutional power is being deployed to try to stop that conversation from happening. That is radically different from what the right has done in trying to keep pornography out of the hands of children. Agree
See, that's
or disagree?
A key point.
I'm sure you agree.
No, that's a key point on children, because we do censor certain ideas from children because they're not capable of handling it at that age. That is a moral position that we ought to take, that, yeah, there are some things my kid won't see. I don't want him or her to see because it's damaging to them at that age. And I would argue many of these things are damaging to people at any age. That's why I said in the previous podcast, and this isn't just my opinion, I've researched this actually many years ago, a Harvard professor wrote about this, that the First Amendment does not protect pornography. It never did. Now, as I say, there may be courts since then that have decided it does, but I would argue that pornography is a public health issue and the First Amendment does not protect it. And if the government wanted to censor pornography, it could. Now, some people are going to hate me for that, but I think that's what's best for everybody. But let me add another aspect to this, that when you're in a school library, you as a librarian or as the school itself can't allow every book into the library. There's a limited number of books they can have. This isn't so much a matter of censorship as it is a matter of selection. What books will we select that are most appropriate for children? They're not so much saying these books are inappropriate. They're saying, well, they are saying that, but we're also saying these are the books that we must have in the library because those are the books they need to learn what they need to learn at this age. So it's not as much censorship as it is selection. And so when you couple that with the age issue, I don't think the right and the left are talking about the same thing. They're not trying to do the same thing. The right is selecting appropriate material for kids, and the left is saying not even adults can see anything that disagrees with our ideology. So,
it gets really wild too, because mm-hmm. you would see the left up in arms if you were trying to suggest that kids should be reading the Bible in school, you know, like,
yeah,
God forbid you place a Bible in front of them. What they would much rather the kids have in front of them is graphic porn. Mm-hmm. That's what they would rather kids be reading. They would prefer that to the Bible.
Yeah. Well, it's a good point.
That's just outrageous.
Right.
But I mean, do they think that, when an R rating is slapped on a movie that has sex scenes in it, graphic sex scenes, and so it's for R rating is for 17 plus, is that censorship? You know, when a theater doesn't allow a 12-year-old to buy a ticket to that movie, is that inappropriate censorship, or is it perfectly appropriate to try to prevent the 12-year-old from seeing that film? I mean, these are things that have always kind of been in place. There never needed to be a law that said you can't put porn in a kindergarten library because nobody was insane enough to even try to do it.
That's right.
Now they're actually proactively trying. It didn't happen by accident. They're purposefully trying to stuff these books in there. But it goes to other things too. It's not just the pornography. It's also things like, the critical race theory, learning materials that will teach, for example, white kids that they are essentially evil because of the color of their skin and the actions of their ancestors. They are the oppressors. They are the tyrants. It's their turn to sit and be quiet and listen to the lived experiences of other races. And so demonizing kids on the basis of their skin color is also a problematic thing to be teaching children. And so that is outside of the category of obscenity and lewdness, but it's still a conversation that needs to be had in terms of what's appropriate to be teaching our kids.
Well, these kids can't read, they can't write, they can't do arithmetic, but they can know that maybe they're in the wrong gender, they're in the wrong body. I mean, that's right. How crazy it's gotten. And whose fault is it, ladies and gentlemen? I would submit to you, it's largely the church's fault, because the church is supposed to be the conscience of the nation, and we have allowed this for too long. In fact, I don't know if you agree with this, Seth, but I think the Trump candidacy from 2015 was really more a result of Christians being derelict in their duty over the decades than it was that Trump was any great candidate. I thought they saw somebody who came up and would say things other candidates wouldn't say, that he was so politically incorrect. And they saw that we got to a point in our country where things were going so badly from a moral perspective that they finally said, despite this guy appears to be immoral personally, at least he's calling things out that nobody else will call out. And he's calling these things out that probably never should have surfaced, that shouldn't have been problems if the church had been engaged for decades, but it hadn't been. And so now they're going, oh, Trump is our savior. He's going to save us.
Yeah.
I think that's really what's beyond, what's kind of been underneath the Trump candidacy. And from my perspective anyway, I thought Ron DeSantis was a far better candidate than Donald Trump for 2024. And yet he didn't get any traction at all. And I think it's largely because many Christians have just said, look, Trump, despite the fact that he doesn't appear to be moral personally, he's our savior. I don't know if you agree with that or not.
DeSantis has had a great track record in calling things out and mm-hmm. and engaging the political correctness. You know, he's dealt with this issue of the pornography being in kids' schools. Right. He's taken on Disney and woke indoctrination of children, critical race theory, DEI. You know, he's taken a hard line on violence and lawlessness and isn't tolerating any of that. He's done an excellent job as governor in Florida. It's not because of any deficiencies in DeSantis. I don't think that people have preferred Trump. I think a lot of the reason is, Trump has already been president once. A lot of people believe that he should have been president again and that was taken from him unjustly. Mm-hmm. A lot of people believe that. And they also are justifiably, in my opinion, very motivated to support him as a result of the effort to get him off the ballot and put him in prison. Mm. And the extent to which he's being indicted and charged with things like, if you go out in search of a crime and you just throw everything at the wall to see what sticks, maybe you can get something. Is that the right way to be approaching this, though? Is that how the justice system should be weaponized in these cases? I mean, couldn't you do that with Hillary Clinton if you really wanted to?
Or Joe Biden. Yeah.
Or Joe Biden, yeah. Anybody in the Biden family.
The big guy.
I just think for the that big it's guy. Mm-hmm. Exactly that double standard and the weaponization of the justice system, including the, you know, going after people who were at the January 6th on January 6th were at the Capitol, who were just, you know, standing around and protesting or whatever, but peacefully, you know, they weren't necessarily doing anything. You still have the weaponization of the Department of Justice to come after them and try to put them in prison. And so I think a lot of that has motivated people to say, well, you know, DeSantis can wait his turn. Right now, Trump is the issue. Trump was supposed to be president. It was taken from him. And now he's being politically persecuted. And they're certainly on that last point. They're certainly not wrong about that. It is persecution, political persecution, what's going on with Trump. And so I understand why people are really fired up and wanting to support him now.
Yeah, that makes sense as well. Although I would argue that, yes, the Justice Department has been politicized before, but it's been politicized a lot more in recent years. And part of the problem it is politicized again is because Christians haven't been as engaged as they should have been. And then when we see the dam about to break, we're looking for somebody who can prevent it from breaking completely. And Christians go, well, this guy Trump appears to be fearless on these issues. We're just going to get behind him. Despite right. the fact that the dam should not have been breaking if we had been involved like we should have been over the past several decades, and we haven't been. So, yeah, that's and let me ask you another question about this when it comes to debates between the left and the right. It always seems that the left wants to cancel people rather than debate issues. Why is that from your perspective?
Well, it's certainly a lot easier. It's certainly a lot easier to call someone names and try to dismiss what they say than to actually engage with what they say. And it's even easier if you have the power to take their voice away entirely so that you don't have to engage with them at all. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the uses of censorship is to insulate yourself from criticism so that, you know, that your political opponents can't get traction and they can't expose your arguments. They can't expose foolishness for what it is. They can't even engage in mockery or ridicule because it's off limits. It's a way of protecting a narrative and an ideology and your ideas that you want to insulate. So that's, I think, primarily the most common and the most common purpose for censorship. And it's effective to those ends. It's why tyrants have historically engaged in heavy-handed control of the media. You know, controlling what stories can be covered and how they can be covered. They do that for a reason. Historically, it's happened for a reason. And now we see it happening for exactly the same reason, just in different ways, because now you have the biggest threat to speech right now is not necessarily government control of the media, although I think the media is in lockstep with the government most of the time. But, you know, these privately owned big tech platforms where discourse is happening on a wide scale, they're also in lockstep with the government and being influenced by the government through back channels. And so that's a huge threat, and that needs to be dealt with sooner rather than later.
In fact, there's a Supreme Court case right now that the Supreme Court has regarding the Biden administration using big tech to censor people online. I'll be curious to see how they rule there. It probably is going to come out next month toward the end of June. That's when the Supreme Court often delays most of their big decisions to the final week, and then they all get out of town.
Yeah. So look, go hide somewhere.
That's right. Look for the end of June for that decision. To paraphrase something C.S. Lewis said, he said, it's not the issues we debate that are the problem. It's the issues that we don't debate and are considered settled that are the problem. Mm. And if you ever hear people say, ladies and gentlemen, the science is settled or science says, recall what we've said on this program many times before, and I unpack in the book, Stealing from God. Science doesn't say anything. Scientists do. And mm-hmm. sometimes the scientists are swayed by groupthink. Sometimes they're tempted by the same three temptations the rest of us are tempted by: sex, money, and power. In fact, when you look at the COVID situation, a lot of people made a lot of money and had a lot of power by shutting other people down, by shutting the whole country down, and by insisting that everybody got the clot shot, the vaccine. And when you're called a vaccine denier, rather than, and then you're censored, rather than having your views actually considered in give and take debate, you know that the people doing this are probably in the wrong. Most of the time, the censors are in the wrong. And so let me ask this question. Well, go ahead, yeah, Seth. Pick up on that.
Hold on to your question, because I just want to say they're always in the wrong if they're censoring, because it doesn't. They may actually be right about the facts, and those facts may hold, right?
Mm-hmm.
However, the problem is, and I actually mentioned this in my in the cross-examination, like Q&A part of that testimony that we played
before
the last
Congress.
Time we talked.
Yeah,
yeah, before
mm-hmm.
Congress. The idea, the justification that's often given for censorship of information like COVID misinformation, you know, being mm. censored, the justification that's given is, well, it was based on what we knew at the time. So at the time, we believed that masking worked, and that's why we were recommending masking. And now we understand, you know, that masking doesn't, whatever. Like, they may change over time in response to whatever the studies say and whatever the CDC has decided to base their guidelines on in any given moment. And that is, and but that justification they're going to, where they're saying it was based on what we knew at the time, is not a justification for censorship. In fact, what I say is it's a knockdown argument against censorship, because if knowledge changes over time, then you can never say with confidence at this moment, here's what you're allowed to say because it's true, and here's what you're not allowed to say because it's false. What if tomorrow that changes? What if our knowledge changes and you have to make an adjustment to that true false binary? Well, then you censored people who were saying true things yesterday. So if you're going to say that knowledge changes over time, then a entailment of that, what follows from that, is that you must not censor at any given moment in time as if you know what's true and know that it will be true tomorrow.
That's an excellent point. And science is a enterprise that is tentative for that very reason. New information comes in that overturns previous scientific theories. Now,
right, and that's how you get to the truth, is by hosting that debate and allowing people to say, you know what, we're pretty confident that this is true, but let's continue to invite criticism and dialogue because we may be wrong. The humility that says we may be wrong and we invite that dialogue is the fastest and best way to get to the truth.
Excellent. Yeah, in fact, any claim to censorship is normally a claim to infallibility.
Yes.
And omniscience. I know enough already. I don't need to hear from you. What you're saying can't possibly be true because I already know the answer. That's ideology, friends. That's not science. Okay. And so when the government was actually censoring Stanford PhD epidemiologists through big tech, you knew there was a problem, and there still is a problem. In fact, I don't know, Seth, I know the CDC may have recently admitted that they've made some mistakes on the COVID issue. I think they have, but I don't know what to believe anymore on that issue because there's so much misinformation and so much ideology. I mean, especially if we can take ourselves back 4 years ago, May of 2020, when the George Floyd thing hit, suddenly social distancing wasn't required anymore if you were protesting for the right thing. Certainly masks weren't necessary. And once the vaccine came out about 6 months later, if you were coming across the border, you didn't need a vaccine. Only the people in America needed a vaccine. You knew it was political then.
Yeah.
And yet they were censoring people that had a different point of view. People we are learning more and more today actually had it closer to the truth than the CDC had it. Now, how does this affect this kind of censorship? How does it affect us right now when we go to our doctor?
Well, it's certainly there's certainly pressure applied to doctors to not step out of line and say or do the wrong thing. I think that they're trying to be careful about whether they're falling in line with what they call them guidelines, but it's like preferred pronouns. They're not preferred. They're required, right? There's a penalty if you don't go along with it. So it's not just a preference or a guideline. I think there's a lot of pressure on them. There's a lot of hushed conversations that happen where they say, you know, I've seen in my practice, I've seen these things, but I really, you know, shouldn't be saying this, and don't tell anyone I said this. Doctors face that pressure all the time, and they're worried about their careers. And so, if they're worried about their good name and their careers, they're more likely than not to go along with whatever the narrative is that's being pushed on them, just to go along to get along. And that doesn't mean that doesn't it's not good for you as the patient, because that means that what you're getting from your doctor isn't even necessarily what your doctor personally believes. It's what the doctor feels they must do and say in order to safeguard their career and their reputation. So I think that is a recipe for disaster when it comes to healthcare.
And they can lose their license if they get out of line on any of these things. Yes. I was talking to a doctor just the other day in Nashville, and he couldn't prescribe ivermectin. Ivermectin, a drug that had zero side effects for decades, yet he couldn't prescribe it, and we now know that it actually worked to prevent COVID. I'm reading just a paragraph here from my book, Correct, Not Politically Correct, about same-sex marriage and transgenderism, where I say on page 183, the University of Minnesota Medical School in the fall of 2022, that school insisted that their incoming class of students take an overtly political rather than medical oath, which included recognizing, quote, inequities built by past and present traumas rooted in white supremacy, colonialism, the gender binary, ableism, and all forms of oppression, unquote. Now, I go on to write, excuse me, but recognizing that there is a true gender binary is medically necessary for properly treating patients. Men do not need pap smears and women do not need prostate checks. Men and women are also susceptible to different conditions and diseases. They also metabolize some medicines differently. Ignoring these details can be deadly. Mm-hmm. Ladies and gentlemen, censorship and wokeism is affecting your medical health and what your doctor can and can't say or do or prescribe. And unless Christians and other conservatives start speaking up, this is going to continue. And
I just had a doctor visit recently, and they needed some updated information from me, and they had me fill out this form. And they actually didn't need updated information. All my information was already on file. I was asking for like my name, my date of birth, my address. I'm like, you guys have this information already. But there was a new question on there about what my gender identity was. And I checked the other box and then wrote in the other box, you know, like, why, what do you need this information for? Like, what if I told you that I was a woman? Is that how you're going to treat me? You're going to treat me as a woman? Like, why? What does that information matter to you? What is my mental state matter to how you're going to treat me physically? It doesn't have any relevance at all. So maybe they just want to know what pronouns to call me when I'm in the office. I don't know, but I hate seeing that. Maybe it's time to find a new doctor. I hate seeing that stuff in medical settings. It's the last place that it should be. It shouldn't be anywhere, but it certainly shouldn't be in medical settings where biology matters.
Exactly. And it's not bigotry, it's biology, ladies and gentlemen. In fact, I thought I saw you on your Twitter feed. Ladies and gentlemen, follow Seth on Twitter, on X, Seth Dillon, at Seth Dillon. I thought I saw you retweeting a newspaper headline that said something like, biology is a fact.
Yeah, that was the over in the UK, the NHS, I guess, had declared. This was a declaration that sex is a biological fact. And my comment on that was, I mean, we haven't been making progress if we've gotten to a point where that declaration is necessary. We've been going the wrong way. We've been on the wrong road for a long time. If it's necessary for the National Health Service to come out and say, hey, everybody, we just need you all to know that sex is a biological fact. Like, that was not necessary to say just a matter of a few years ago, and now it is. So we're certainly not progressing.
To paraphrase C.S. Lewis again, he said, when you find yourself on the wrong road, the surest way to get back on the right road is to turn around. Continuing down the road you're on is not the solution.
No.
You need to turn around and go back. When you need the National Health Service of the UK to come out and declare that biology is a fact, you know that there's something really screwy going on in the medical world, and we need to turn around and get back.
Yes, and the man who turns back soonest is the most progressive, he said. That's how you make true progress, is go back and find the right road.
Exactly. All right, let me ask you a question now. It not only affects our medical health, this wokeism, this, and censorship as well. How about what your kid is going to learn in school? I mean, that seems to go without saying now. It's just amazing that we're having arguments of whether or not there ought to be pornography in school. These kids can't read, write, or do arithmetic, but they know their gender. You have young kids, Seth. Are you sending them to public school? What are you doing with them? When they get to college age, what are you going to do?
So, that's down the road. My kids are 10 and 8, so it's not an immediate, urgent problem for us to figure out exactly what we're going to do when it comes time for them to go to college, but we do need to be thinking about that. They go to a private Christian school right now, and so they're getting sound teaching there. And I think this is an important thing with kids, is that right now there's a race to the most fertile soil when it comes to ideas and where they're accepted and where they grow and flourish is the most fertile soil is the mind of a young child. And there's a race right now to try to plant ideas there first. Who's going to get there first? Is it going to be the secular progressive left that has decided that it's possible to be a girl trapped in a boy's body and it's probably happening a lot more than you think, and we need to try to figure out who these trans kids are and affirm them and sterilize and mutilate them and blah, 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 on and on. Is it going to be them or is it going to be us planting the truth there first? And it's a race to see who can get it there first, because if your kids are equipped with the truth, then they're going to see this stuff for what it is when they finally encounter it in life, later on in life, when they encounter it in college, and they're going to be equipped to deal with it. But if you haven't planted the truth there first, then it's just that soil's just there ready to take whatever seeds are planted in it. And it's going to grow into some, horrific nightmare that you're going to be dealing with as your child becomes a young adult and goes out into the world. And then the culture is going to suffer for it. And you will have played a role in fueling that by sending your kid into the world as one of the ambassadors of this madness. And so I think that's the fight of our time. There are a lot of different issues that really matter right now, but the one that matters most to me as a parent of young children is who's planting what in my children's minds and who's getting there first.
Well said. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, that's why we develop curricula for kids. We've got Train Your Brain, a course in logic for 6th to 8th graders. And if you've never had a course in logic, even as an adult, you ought to take it. In fact, I sometimes read kids' books to understand stuff better, just tell you the truth. So get the Train Your Brain course. In fact, we're going to run it this fall, but you can take it anytime you want in a self-paced way. There's several other courses. Let's Get Real. Yes, God is Real. These are all courses for kids. If you go to crossexamine.org, click on online courses, you will see it there. Also want to mention, I'm going to be out in near Pittsburgh with Lisa Childers and Natasha Crane for the Unshaken Conference on May 18th. That's a Saturday. We'll get to looking forward to meeting you all there. We're going to have at the end of the conference, we're going to line up and meet everybody. Anybody that wants to meet us, sign any books for yourself or gift books for other people. So look forward to seeing you at the Unshaken Conference. Go to unshakenconference.com or go to our website. That's May 18th. Also, several events in Charlotte. I'm at Central Church of God every Wednesday night this month. We're doing If God, Why Evil? Does Jesus Trump Your Politics? And Should You Follow Your Heart? You're going to want to be a part of that. And go to crossexamine.org for more on that. Don't forget about our archaeology series, Digging Up the Bible. This Monday night, we'll be talking more evidence for the crucifixion. In fact, we're gonna unveil 6 people in the Bible that had something to do with the crucifixion and show you all these people have been found in the dirt. This Monday night, 7 p.m. Eastern time, go to our website, go to our YouTube channel, crossexamine.org, to see it. All right, let me go back for one final question with my guest, the great Seth Dillon from the Babylon Bee. How does the censorship affect you? And not just you at the Babylon Bee, Seth, but comedy and satire in general.
Well, it's speech suppression. So what it does is it makes comedy, it essentially outlaws it. You know, when Elon bought Twitter, he declared comedy legal again. What he was suggesting was that comedy had been made illegal. It had been outlawed. It was considered, harmful and offensive and hateful. And that's the problem. The comedy has always had, there's always somebody who's offended by jokes. Like whenever you're making jokes, somebody's got to be the butt of the joke, you know, whether it's you or your ideas, something that is the butt of the joke. It could be somebody else and you're laughing and you think it's fine. And then when it hits you, you know, that's when people really get upset about jokes, is when it affects their feelings. But that's just the nature of comedy. It's how comedy works, and it's why comedy is healthy, is because it actually helps us examine ourselves and our own motivations and our own double standards and our own inadequacies and mistakes. It helps us take ourselves less seriously and come to terms with those things. And so there's a healthy and healing power to comedy that is restricted when you start suggesting that jokes themselves are harmful. Instead of healing, they're actually harmful, and people should be kept in safe spaces and insulated from them. You end up killing comedy when you do that. And you have a lot of comedians who are thankfully being very vocal and speaking out about the dangers of this. I know Joe Rogan has, Dave Chappelle has, recently you had Jerry Seinfeld coming out and saying that, you know, this PC woke culture from these hard leftists has really killed comedy. You can't just go home at the end of the day anymore and relax and watch just funny sitcoms or funny late night shows that are making you laugh. They're all just, you know, safeguarding and promoting whatever the popular narrative is. And that's not funny. And it's everything that is funny is being ruled out. And he sees that as being kind of a negative, because not only he's a comedian, it's his job to be funny and to make these jokes. But it's just not healthy for society to have this, all these areas roped off where you say that we shouldn't joke about these things. That wouldn't be good. I think we're in a much better, I think we were a lot healthier. If you go back 20, 30 years ago, when we were joking about each other kind of indiscriminately, and we didn't have so many areas roped off where we were trying to safeguard people's ideas and feelings. We all got along better, and it allowed us to kind of, the rifts that were there and the tension that was there, we were able to kind of laugh at ourselves and each other across those lines and barriers, and it was unifying, and we've lost that.
I remember you and I were speaking at a conference that Charlie Kirk put on a couple of years ago, and you said this, which I think was very insightful. You said that the late night comedians are no longer looking for laughter. They're looking for applause. Mm-hmm. Explain what you meant by that.
Yeah, and somebody, I don't know who it was, I need to find out, because I mention this all the time, but somebody coined the term clapter for that. It's when you're going for the applause of affirmation instead of just the laughter of amusement. You know, you're trying to get the crowd, and you'll notice this if you watch late night comedy. They're doing a song and dance about the vaccine and how good the vaccine is. It's not funny. It's just a promotion of whatever the popular narrative is right now, instead of making fun of that. And so a lot of it is preaching and it's emotionally driven, and it's promoting the popular narrative, and it's generating applause from their audience, who is, you know, just loving the fact that they're as liberal and politically correct as they are. That's not funny. That's not comedy. Comedy challenges these things. Comedy subverts these. It's very subversive and tries to undermine, you know, the cultural and institutional power by pointing out where its overreaches are, where it's leading us into foolish or dangerous territory. And if you're not doing that, you're not doing comedy.
Well, that's an interesting point, that the very people that say they're against oppression are the ones who are denuturing one of the greatest tools of the oppressors.
Yes.
What they're actually taking the ability away to make fun of people that may be oppressing others.
Well, because they're nominally against, I mean, they are themselves tyrants. That's why,
right.
They claim to be fighting tyranny while they're engaging in it.
Yeah, that's well said. Now, Seth, tell us the final thing about the Babylon Bee. I just love the Babylon Bee. I love the work you guys do. I've been privileged to be a part of it on occasion with interviews and that kind of thing. You guys do have a subscription service. What is the subscription service? What do you get if you become a subscriber to the Babylon Bee?
Well, you get a few things. If you go to babylonbee.com/plans, you can pick a subscription plan. We have a few different tiers that have different benefits. You do get access to some exclusive material that we just put out to our subscribers. We do some articles and videos and things just for subscribers sometimes. We also have some features on the site and on the app. We have an app that you can get from the App Store on either Android or iPhone. Like our headline pitching forum, for example, where you can actually pitch ideas to us that we may publish if they're good enough. Our writers and editors are in there engaging with those people who are pitching, and we publish from our audience all the time. So it's a fun way to kind of engage with our team and be involved in the creative process if you're a subscriber. But the primary thing that you're doing when you subscribe to the Babylon Bee is you're not unlocking this giant library of valuable content. What you're doing is you're providing us with the support that we need to be independent from big tech, so that we can take a stand like we did against Twitter, refuse to censor ourselves, lose that platform if necessary, and still keep going because we have an army of subscribers that are back.
Yeah, to close the loop on what we discovered in the first show, ladies and gentlemen, when Elon Musk bought Twitter, one of the first things he did was reinstate the Babylon Bee on Twitter, on X, rightfully so, because he is advocating for free speech. And you know, Elon, as far as we know, is not a Christian, but he's doing the work that Christians ought to be doing, and that is supporting supporting the right that we all have to say what's on our mind, given the certain limits that we spoke about earlier. So thank God for Elon Musk.
Yes. And the big lesson that he's teaching us right now is even as he's telling these advertisers that they can take their money elsewhere if they're going to hold it over his head and try to manipulate him into censoring more people. Mm-hmm. He's telling them, look, I don't care about your money. This isn't about money for me. This is about the principle of free speech. You can't buy me with your money. And the lesson to walk away with from that is that, like Elon Musk, we have to stop caring what freedom might cost us. We have to be willing to pay a price. We have to be willing to lose the platform. We have to be willing to lose the advertiser revenue. We have to be willing to stand by our convictions and stand for freedom and be willing to pay a price for it, or we will lose it.
Yeah, you have to be willing to lose your job, ladies and gentlemen, at some point. You can't continue to cower under your desk while the woke mob takes over your corporation. You've got to stand up at some point.
Or it'll never change. Then your children are going to inherit an even more messed up world than the one that you're in. And if that's the path that you want to keep going down, great. Keep your head down. Stay quiet just to keep your job.
Yeah, it's not going to end well, ladies and gentlemen. Well, Seth, it's always a pleasure having you on. Thanks for the work you're doing. As I've said before, I really think the Babylon Bee, even though it is a business, is also a ministry, because you can say things that even the other side will laugh at, and they will get the point that if I said it in just a straight didactic way, it would bounce right off their heads. So what you're doing is great. I know most of the people that work there are Christians, and you're really doing great work. So keep it up, brother.
Thank you, Frank. You too.
That's Seth Dillon of the Babylon Bee. Go to BabylonBee.com, ladies and gentlemen. Do what I do. Subscribe. It's well worth it. Even if you don't get in the back end and use a lot of the stuff back there, you are supporting a great organization. And by the way, it's an evangelism tool as well. I send this to non-Christian friends to get them laughing. And then they start trafficking on the Babylon Bee, and they might be able then to get the message of Jesus through comedy. That's important. All right, friends. We will see you here next week, Lord willing. God bless.